Come with us.
When you wish upon a star.
Come and remember the magic.
What's up, all you rad dudes and dudettes? Welcome to 90s Disney, your podcast for everything about Disney in the 90s. I'm your host, AJ Minotti, joined by my brothers, Mike Minotti.
Hi, and I want Chris to show us his new skill when you call on him.
Okay, Chris, underwater, Minotti.
Oh, now pressure's on.
You did so good. We were so pressed. You got this.
How long?
It's good.
I got to start rolling first.
We did not know you could do this until tonight.
He caught me off guard. My kids love that new Wonka movie, so we try to like do it a little bit.
Why are you so good at that?
Right? That's probably all I can say, though. Like, Donald Duck can only say a few things.
Yeah.
I got like 10 phrases.
That's pretty good. All right.
Well, very auspicious too, Chris, because it's episode 59 today.
I know. I was bummed because it was planned out that this was going to be mine, but you know, other episodes happened.
Why is 59 matter?
So 59... When I was doing like little league football or whatever, I was randomly chosen the number 59. Ever since that fateful day, this number follows me like Jim Carrey in the number 23, minus like the death and random weirdness.
Minus Satan.
Satan.
Except for that.
But and it will follow you now too, like a haunted mansion.
You're in, everybody.
That's right. Yeah. You will notice the number 59 more.
You have to tweet at us or something every time you see the number
like,
59.
It was an argument with guys at work. So my one boss was like, 59, what's the big deal? Just pick 28. So we created a hangout called 59 versus 28. And there were 1,000 more 59 pictures sent from everyone than 28.
You have this hangout 59 versus 28. And you'd think 28 would show up more. It's a lower number. You know?
No, it's everywhere. I could do a whole podcast about funny 59 scenarios.
Well, that's not what we're doing a podcast about today, though, right, AJ?
No, we are doing a podcast about Honey, I Shrunk the Audience, the 4D theater attraction that opened at Epcot on November 21st, 1994.
Why does it seem like there's so many things in 94 specifically?
94 was a good year, man.
Yeah. Well, because that you think about it, like they started the Disney decade, a few years go by, now they're ready to push things out. Like,
it takes coming out.
Years. It's also the Lion King year, so they're having a big one.
Yes, but while that was the biggest movie of the year, the biggest movie for this box office weekend was none other than Star Trek Generations.
Ooh, it's shitty.
That's a movie that, like, it's not amazing, but I sure do like watching it.
It's a good fan service film.
Well, and what's fun about it is, like, that's the one where they are using, like, the sets and the costumes mostly still from Star Trek Next Generation, right?
Well, and it's an early fan service film. Like, you get that stuff every week nowadays, you know? Back then, it was like, holy crap, novel. Can you believe
this? Picard together.
Right, exactly. The ultimate fan service thing is still Unification Part 1 and 2 for me, or even Relics, the one with Scotty.
Right,
the show. But, it's fine. It's fine. It's one of the better ones. Like, when it comes to the Next Generation movies, First Contact, you have everything else.
Right, for sure.
Yeah, but this is not a Star Trek pod.
No, it's a Boys to Men podcast because the number one song was I'll Make Love to You.
Hey, we all knew this in our awkward dances in the school.
I feel like this one's come up before, too.
It has. Yeah. This one played for a long
time.
Which
is weird that in like middle school dances, they played this song.
Yeah, I don't think they were listening too closely to the lyrics.
It's called I'll Make Love to You.
I heard that phrase all the time when I was a kid, and I did not know that what it meant. Yeah. Because because of songs like this. I was like,
it was mainstream.
I guess you're going to get a hug. I don't know.
And 3 days earlier, November 18th, Donkey Kong Country released.
Dang, what a week.
What do you remember about the launch of Donkey Kong Country, Mike?
The VHS that they sent us?
No, that giant banner outside Toys R Us. It was like, Donkey Kong Country now available.
What's funny is I appreciate Donkey Kong Country more now than I did then. Like, I liked it then. I don't know if it's probably because it was hard.
Well, you know the technical achievements behind it, too.
Yeah, SGI and the pre-rendered sprites and all that stuff. Yeah. Cool.
One of the executives at Nintendo thought it was a Nintendo 64 game when he saw it.
Impressive.
But this is not a Nintendo podcast, although I do those on Tuesdays, so please check out Last of the Nintendo.
Always
be pitching.
That's right. Always be selling. Coffee's for sellers, Edge guy.
That's right. Okay, let's take a look at some of the early history of the Honey, I Shrunk franchise, I guess you could call it. The original film, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, was released in 1989 to great success. The most successful Disney live-action film ever to that point.
Wow, really? Yeah.
And then that same year, Little Mermaid comes out. So this was really, you know, Little Mermaid kind of kickstarted the animation, but Honey, Shrunk the Kids was big for live-action.
And, like, all of Disney live-action history, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, all, like, everything, this was it.
In the late 80s, even before the animation was getting off, Disney was kind of rebounding thanks to live-action efforts. And that's something Eisner did bring, because he came from Paramount, where he worked on things like Star Trek, actually. So, you know, Splash was the first one to make a big splash. You know, you had, like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit and a lot of these movies, Flight of the Navigator even, these hits. And then, yeah, it kind of just... They really found a groove there making these family-friendly live-action movies. Like, a genre that doesn't even really exist anymore.
It does now, but it's, like, straight to Disney Plus stuff.
Right, exactly. You know? Yeah. But back in the day when one of the biggest movies of the year could be a live-action family comedy, right? And that would be, like, big, expensive special effects showpiece. And this actually was.
I don't have the numbers in front of me. This movie did not have a huge budget for the time. It was like $15 million, and it made like $130-something.
Was this one of Rick? Was this? No, Ghostbusters was first. Rick was big from that, and then...
Yeah, he was big at this point. Star is a strong word, maybe, but he definitely... He was in the comedy realm.
Yeah, people knew.
I think this definitely helped in terms of like more of a starring vehicle, even though the kids are honestly more... Probably a more
right, but who's on the poster?
Right, it's Rick Moranis.
Right,
what do you guys think about this movie? When was the last time you've seen
it? It's been a minute since I've seen it. I loved it as a kid, and I was terrified of it as a kid.
So I remember loving these. Well, all three of the movies, honestly. But we recently showed our children this, maybe three or four months ago. I absolutely loved it still, and I liked it a lot.
I got to bring it back up for the kids to see if they're
but
into it.
But it is just such an interesting concept, especially now as like an adult, and you see like these kids going through this. Like, oh, wow, that's
terrifying. It's an interesting movie as a kid because it's truly the kids are thrown into this like hostile yet familiar environment, and they have to like survive it on their own. But it's kind of like a kid power sort of thing.
Right, too. And as a kid, you kind of want to still, even though it's hostile, be a part of that in some way, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the intrigue of it.
It's adventure, it you know?
Yeah. Right, and we've had like other kind of like, get shrunk down movies, but it was always usually like you're going in the human body or like the micro, like you know, you're like the size of an atom.
The mundanity of it is what made it cool. Like seeing like a giant cookie
in your backyard. You
know, yeah, like an ant. Like, what's that like?
Right, the severity of just a little patch of field grass is enough.
Don't bring up Auntie. Or what was his name? Auntie.
Auntie.
Yeah, don't bring up Auntie too soon.
Yeah, I think that was the first movie death I really got upset about.
I think one of my first movies I saw as a kid was one of the NeverEnding Stories.
So
the horse or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a pretty big deal when we were growing up. I don't remember seeing it in theaters necessarily, but it was definitely a VHS staple.
It had it on repeat.
It had one of the Roger Rabbit shorts in front of it, too. I forget which one. I didn't write that down.
It was the kitchen one, wasn't it?
Tummy Trouble?
I think it was Tummy Trouble. That was the first one.
Tummy Trouble, Roller Coaster Rabbit, and then the camping one.
Yeah. That one. There was a moderately successful sequel, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, which came out in 1992.
Also very good. I remember seeing in the main theater at Cinema South in Boardman. I remember that surprisingly vividly still for some reason. And even, you know, I was so young, to my mind, this movie was still kind of scary because it was like the big kid that can maybe squash people.
Yeah, right. Not as scary. It's criticized for being a one-joke movie, which is a thing. You know, the one joke is the baby's getting bigger the whole time. This one, it had a bigger budget. It was like about $40 million. It made about...
Honey, I blew up the budget.
Yeah, it made about $60 million domestically, and overseas it made more. So, I mean, it still was successful. It's not like the big sensation. Shoot, what was I just going to say? I always thought the phrase blew up the kid was
odd. It's a little like, what's going
like
on
you,
here?
I guess it's like, you know, the way you blow up a photo.
Well, and honestly, that's kind of a joke, too, in what we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, they make that gag a couple times. But
we watched this one again recently, and something that stuck out to me is like how pretty good the practical effects were with like when the baby is like as big as like, let's say Hagrid, you know, it's just a super big guy. You only see his back.
Yeah.
He's running around and the son's trying to chase him down.
It's basically
pretty
just a
good
of,
stuff like that.
Basically a lot of body doubles in layer, just compositing. Right.
And giant props like the shoe.
It was in the queue, right? For,
They had that shoe.
The backlot tour.
Must've been. Yeah. So then to get this IP into the parks as quickly as possible, again, movie came out in 1989. By 1990, they had Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movie set adventure open at MGM Studios.
And that thing lasted there forever. I wish, it's funny because like, you know, eventually you grow out of it. You don't go there anymore. I wish we went back to it more often because there was something interesting about that. Of all the kind of like quote unquote playgrounds that have been built up in parks, like Donald's Boat or whatever, right. This one was definitely the coolest.
There's also in the early days of the Backlot Tour where you were going through one of the sound stages of the line. Remember they had like, they would pick two kids, like ride on the back of the bee. Be in front of a projected screen, yep. Like right. They were
filming part of the tour,
riding yeah. It.
That was part of the original walking tour,
right?
Right. I think
I have a vivid memory of watching that from overhead.
Didn't that section get replaced with the live action 101 Dalmatian mm-hmm. stuff later? Yeah. I believe. Yeah. Remember that weird little like restaurant that they had right next to Honey I Shrunk the Kids' place? That was just like a big big patio.
Yeah, it had sandwiches.
Yeah, I think it was supposed to be back when the tour was like this 2-hour thing. I think you literally like that's where you stopped for lunch.
Right,
the whole gimmick at the time.
Well, that's
it
still,
just became so, another restaurant.
Was that the one that still had like the red and yellow stripes?
Yeah, and it was right by the gag factory.
Right, yeah, right.
It was okay. In between this and like
the big Coke bottle,
light motor
AFI,
action
and the
for
AFI
a
museum.
Yeah, and that stuff. Yep.
That is weird. That's all gone. It is odd.
It's just gone.
That's, I still sometimes Star think Wars of Hollywood Studios. Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, oh, that was there.
So. They still want to develop more attractions around this film because, again, it was a huge hit. I'm sure it had a good life on home video and everything, too. So in November of 1993, they announced an attraction themed around the show called Honey, I Shrunk the Theater.
Oh.
Slightly different name.
That's not what it's called.
Yeah. And this was announced to replace Captain EO for the 1994 season. It was in February of 1994 that they announced a name change to Honey, I Shrunk the Audience.
I think that's a good change because it kind of puts you more into the role.
Right, you're being
right?
shrunk.
Yeah, not the room, you yourself. Yeah.
In fact, it'd be a major problem if they shrunk the theater and not the audience.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
Gruesome.
Yeah. It makes sense. It seems like at this point, all the movies that they would show there had like less than a 10-year life cycle, but mm-hmm. something about that, so... Time for change, you know, and all Michael Jackson's kind of star was already getting a little awkward right. at the moment, right?
Yeah, he was still big, but yeah, there was controversy starting to brew around him.
Things were brewing there, so yeah.
Also, we knew that Kodak would be the sponsor, which made sense. Again, going back to the movie set adventure, that giant roll of Kodak film was a prominent feature there. So
it was always shown on like reels that they would show around.
Right, and Kodak was a huge sponsor across Disney World.
Right, so. Then they sponsor the first film?
I was going to ask you guys.
Because, you know, they had Memories, which I assumed was Kodak.
Yes, they were. Yes, they had to have been if it's making memories and imagery
Magic Journeys.
Show.
I think they did sponsor Magic Journeys.
All right, so let's talk about the production of the film itself. It is directed by Randall Kleiser, who was also the director of Honey, I Blew Up the Kid.
That's interesting. That's actually surprising. They just brought him in,
along with a lot of the cast.
Because they were getting actual movie directors to do this. It was Francis Ford Coppola who directed Captain EO.
Imagineer still played a part, but yeah, they were getting like Hollywood to make these films, which I think is very different from how we've done today and interesting. Randall Kleiser is best known for also directing Grease.
Seriously?
Yeah, he directed Grease. That was like one of his first big projects. Yeah,
I literally just listened to Summer Nights like last night.
He directed
the car. It's pretty cool.
He directed Flight of the Navigator, and I remember White Fang.
That I don't remember.
White Fang. Yeah, that's one of those movies where you have an animal friend. And at the end, you have to say, "Go, White Fang. We don't even want you here anymore."
Like
but you really do, and then you cry.
Right.
Yeah, my friends would call that White Fanging somebody.
Jeez.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
that's the thing. Yeah, that was Disney pushed that movie hard in the early 90s.
Yeah, if I'm reading this right, it was Kodak who did.
Oh, man, cool. Kodak really was everywhere, huh?
Yeah, that's so much
quite
anymore.
The fall from
quite
grace.
The fall for Kodak. It's a bad business to be in.
Well, they missed they missed the pivot.
Yeah,
man. This guy, man, he did a lot.
Yeah. So he, you know, among all these films he worked on was a bunch for Disney, and he had a rapport with the company, and it was Jeffrey Katzenberg who approached him. To work on a 70mm 3D, 4D film experience to replace Captain EO, and he came on board.
He brought up 4D, which is interesting to me. I would have thought 4D was only a thing they ever used in marketing to, like, tourists.
Notice, so we'll talk about this more. So we actually, there's a phenomenal, and we'll link to it in the show notes, you can find a commentary he did for the attraction about 3 years ago on YouTube. And he actually uses the phrase virtual reality a lot when talking about the ride, which
I guess it's not entirely wrong, sure, if we want to. But
just because of the perspective that you're looking
at. I mean, that it's putting you in this situation,
right?
Because you're not wearing the headset.
Well, because, you know, the whole thing is that it's not just a movie with like scenes like Captain EO was. Like, you are in a presence, you are in a place,
you are
in that theater,
you're watching the words. You exist.
Right, exactly.
There's no fourth wall.
Yeah. It's much more like it's tough to be a bug than
right.
Yeah, or even like Muppet Vision, right, which kind of did that. Like, it was still kind of a moving camera.
Right, exactly. This was written by Bill Prady and Steven Spiegel. Now, Bill Prady, we all know best for Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men.
Yes.
The writer and producer of those shows. But he actually got his start writing for Henson on various Muppet projects like Fraggle Rock and Muppet Vision 3D. He was the writer on that.
Well, that makes sense.
He was also he was the producer of The Muppets, the TV show from, like, what, 8 years ago now?
God, is that long ago now?
Yeah, I know. But I love that show. It was such a great good
concept. I think it came out a little too soon. If that was like a Disney Plus thing, I think it may have done better.
Would have been good.
Now, Steven Spiegel is an Imagineer who's still with the company. He has been there since 1990. Mm. Here's some of the stuff he's written for Disney attractions. Dinosaur, Cinemagic, Star Tours, The Adventure Continues, Guardians of the Galaxy Mission Breakout, Spider-Man Web Slingers, Guardians of the Galaxy Cosmic Rewind, and The Avengers Quantum Encounter on the cruise ships.
Oh, really?
That's great.
Oh, I skipped on that at one, I think. That was the meal we skipped on.
You did your upgrade meal?
Yeah. Hey, we talked about Cinemagic before, which is over in Paris.
One of the most surprisingly good things I've ever seen in my life.
Fantastic. What are they changing? They're changing the name of this Disney Paris
Disney
studio.
Magic Adventure?
World Adventure.
I don't know. It was something generic.
But Adventure was in it.
Yes.
Disney Adventure Park, maybe.
I think it might be that generic. I forget.
Steve also appears as a rebel pilot in Star Tours Continues. I don't know which one he is, but he's in there somewhere.
Star Tours.
Go look for him. The cinematographer, which was very important on a project like this, is Dean Kundry. This guy has a massive list of credits. Notably, he worked on all three Back to the Future films.
Oh, he's my favorite cinematographer then.
He literally is, Chris. He did Roger Rabbit, Jurassic Park, The Flintstones, Casper, Apollo 13, and kind of connected, Flubber.
I got to watch Flubber again.
Right? I saw a clip from it the other day, and I was like, oh yeah, Flubber.
I just remember as a kid being disappointed that Flubber wasn't in it that much.
Flubber was in it too much.
Man, maybe
there was a whole dance sequence with the Flubber.
Oh, yeah, sure. But that was like it. That was his big moment.
Wait, enough of that. I want to talk about Casper.
You know what? I actually do too. Go ahead. I was going to bring that up as well.
I went on a little rabbit trail. I started watching clips from that on YouTube. I was like, I bet this holds up.
Well, that was a big movie in the 90s. That's a big movie in the 90s that no one talks about anymore.
Oh, it was some of those groundbreaking mix of CG and live action.
One of the movies that the marketing really worked. I loved going to Pizza Hut.
Had those puppets.
Just because we were kids? Because in my mind, that was a big theatrical event.
Oh, yeah, it was huge.
That no one talks about anymore.
It was huge. I think it's starting to have a little bit of a comeback. Because I feel like more people talk about it
now with Halloween, movies being they always look for a movie that would work for that.
Yeah.
So Casper's been one. And we watched it this past Halloween.
Oh, did you?
And my wife had a great story. Well, pretty funny story that her and her sister would watch this. And when Casper becomes a real boy, in that, attractive child, walks down the stairs, the two of them would just, grab their pillows, stand up, and scream in excitement. a Jonathan Taylor Thomas kind of
incredible thing.
That's, you know?
Yeah.
That's funny.
There was direct-to-video sequels to that. There was, I forget the one. I remember we had the soundtrack to the first direct-to-video sequel.
There was the one that was,
we listened to that.
The one was a prequel. It showed how he, came to be with the uncles, even though they're not really his uncles.
Yeah, and then there was the one with Wendy that they did later. Remember Wendy the Witch or whatever?
Right. We listened to that soundtrack a lot.
We did.
And that song at the end where they're singing Casper, the Friendly Ghost, like the rock version.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyways,
we enjoyed it.
That was our Casper tangent. Sorry. Yeah. Just when you said Casper, I was like, man.
That's good. The guy who played Vinny in Atlantis, the priest he played on sketch comedy, was one of the people who tried to get rid of the ghost. There you go. There's your Disney connection.
And there's another Disney connection. Who's one of the villains? A connection to this.
What? I don't remember.
Eric Idle.
Was he?
He was remembered
is he?
Him and that lady that ends up dying becomes a ghost at the end.
I don't remember that.
I like how you're waiting for answers if I remembered.
Eric Idle just like
I don't remember. Okay, cool.
You remember everything. How do you not remember that?
You found a weakness. Sorry.
Now you're making me doubt myself.
No, you're probably right. You just saw it. I haven't seen the movie in 20 years. Longer than that. Anyway, the effects for this show were done by the Kleiser-Walczak Construction Company, which is actually one of the earliest CG studios founded by a husband and wife team of Jeff Kleiser and Diana Walczak. Yes, Jeff and Randall are brothers.
Oh, well, that's convenient.
Yes. They worked on some of the first CG humans. I'll have to throw this up on social media. They have this singing mo-capped like woman like singing a song. It was like the first time I'd ever done anything like it. Obviously today it looks primitive, but you can understand how 30 years ago this was like, sure. Oh my god, like, right. This is incredible.
The future is now.
They created the first digital stunt double in the movie Judge Dredd.
That's a movie.
That's one I've never seen.
I've seen it. You don't need to.
They did effects work for Honey, I Blew Up the Kids, Stargate, the first two X-Men films, and the first Fantastic Four movie. They also did all the CG for all the theater attractions at the Luxor.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Heck yeah.
The company is located in Massachusetts, and the part of the reason for that is because the guy who directed those, he was like a big effects guy in Hollywood. He was done with Hollywood. He was like semi-retired. He was living in Massachusetts. Luxor reached out to him to create these things. He needed a studio, and this was, you know, pre-internet. And he was saying, like, I don't want to leave Massachusetts. And these guys were just kind of trying to make a name for them. So I was like, we'll move our company to Massachusetts to make these with you. Like, cool. It's fine. One of the biggest projects that these guys worked on, and the reason actually I'm doing this episode is because I found out they did the original CG for The Amazing Adventures of Spider-Man at Universal.
Nice. So just the original, though, not the...
Right, they did not do the redo, but they invented the squinching technique, so the perspective shifts as
right,
you're like
right.
They created that.
Okay.
Yeah. So
it's odd they called their company Construction Company.
I don't know what the origin. The name changed to Synthespians, which is technically still around, but it doesn't seem to be as active.
No, it sounds like a Dungeons and Dragons class to me.
Synthetic thespian.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yes, yeah, it's clever. All right, the score is done by composer Bruce Boughton. He did the score for Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. He has a huge film and TV credit list. Notably for us, he did The Rescuers Down Under.
Oh, that has a great soundtrack.
He did Mickey, Donald, and Goofy in The Three Musketeers.
Yeah, that's one that to me was, because we were a little bit older, that was just like some direct-to-video thing that came out.
It's pretty big now.
Yeah, that's for a lot of people what The Prince and the Pauper was for
exactly.
us.
Exactly. Yeah, well put.
Yeah, because there's a lot of those cards in Lurkana, and all, there was a level in Kingdom Hearts, the 3DS one. Yeah,
there's no Prince and the Pauper card yet.
Not yet. Yeah, that's coming.
Now I'm mad.
Let's see. He composed both Homeward Bound movies.
Oh, those are sad ones there.
The live action Lost in Space.
One of our first DVDs.
That was another big deal. Remember when that movie came out?
That was pure marketing.
Yeah, big time.
He also did Bambi 2.
One of the better of the direct-to-video sequels. Mm-hmm. Patrick Stewart playing Bambi's father in that.
Right.
Man, what a get.
He also did a number of theme park attractions for Disney, including the music for Cinemagic.
Yeah, there's that banger again.
One Man's Dream.
Mm-hmm.
Timekeeper.
Great.
Ellen's Energy Adventure.
That's another. We did an episode on Ellen's Energy Adventure, and we did talk about the score a bit. And that's a very good score. It's similar to this. Not shocking to find out it's the same person.
And he did The Making of Me.
Okay.
save that for last.
I mean,
like,
someone had to do it.
I'd like to hear just the score for The Making
of Me.
Yeah. Man, the fact that was just a theater show in Epcot for a while. Like, how many seats did that theater even fit?
Not many. It felt like a box almost.
It was. That's what I was about to say. I was like, that can't be right. But in my mind, it was like a box in the middle of the pavilion.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Weird.
It wasn't just kept looping. Like, there was, you kind of came in and out.
Man, Wonders of Life was so weird. I missed it. What a weird pavilion.
It's kind of like when you go to like a Hall of Fame or something, like Football Hall of Fame. They're just a continuous movie playing.
Right, exactly.
You kind of sit there a little and go out.
No, in my mind, it was more of a like, there was like a queue and there was like show times. It wasn't like the goofy thing.
I don't remember a queue.
Whereas, like, maybe it wasn't open air.
Right. You're boxed in.
Yeah, it was weird.
It's worth saying, I love the music for this attraction.
It's very good.
I think I'll use as the outro music on this episode so you get a little taste, but it's a very catchy pop. Yes.
Yeah, and you hear it a lot, and you'll hear other podcasts. It's on the WW radio. You'll probably recognize the people. It's just good stuff.
Yep. The set was designed and built by Les Dilley. This is a set constructor who worked on Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Empire Strikes Back, Alien, and The Abyss.
Oh, is that it?
There's some like crazy talent
That's what I was going back to. Hollywood, man.
Yeah, like, you know, big time.
Like, I mean, Alien, some of the most important stuff in that movie is kind of the set.
Yeah.
Actually, that's like might be the best thing about that movie is just how good like
the set design is.
Yeah, like the ship and like the alien ship and all that stuff looks so wow.
Mm-hmm. The cast features a number of people returning from the first film and the second film. Rick Moranis, of course, back as Wayne Szalinski.
Rick Moranis is such a treasure. He was you were, even as a kid, you were always excited to see him in something.
I'll never forget the first time Dark Helmet took off that helmet, and I didn't know it was going to be Rick Moranis. Yeah, I was so happy.
I know. It was so funny. That's probably my favorite role.
He's so good. Because it's just so against type, but he plays it so perfectly.
Oh, he does.
He's probably a highlight of Brother Bear, right?
It makes me want to watch it again, honestly.
Seriously.
Yeah. Just for him. Love Rick Moranis. It was funny because he did have like this big Disney connection for a good while
there. Yeah. Marcia Strassman plays Diane Zelinsky, his wife.
His wife. Welcome back, Cotter.
Yes, thank you. Robert Oliveri plays Nick Zelinsky, his oldest son.
And this is like the kid from the movie.
Oh, yeah. From
both movies, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's shocking.
The young son, Adam Zelinsky, the baby who was blown up, is played by twins, Daniel and Joshua Shalikar, which was a common thing with young kids to get around labor laws. You'd catch a twin.
Hence Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, exactly. Things like that.
Yep.
Apparently, because neither of them continued acting, according to Kleiser in his commentary, Daniel is a New Jersey police officer and Joshua is a web designer.
Good for them.
So there you go.
Can you imagine getting arrested by Nick Zelinsky?
No, Adam.
Oh, worse.
The baby. Didn't you terrorize Vegas?
You think somebody ever tries to pull that and get pulled over for speeding?
I don't think they recognize it.
It might not go over well.
Noticeably absent from the show is the character of Amy Zelinsky, the oldest daughter. She was played by Amy O'Neill in the first two films. She'd actually quit acting shortly before this went into production to pursue other interests.
Well, and it's funny because in the sequel, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, she was in that just for like the first like opening scene because she was going off to college. And for some reason, I went down a little rabbit hole after I watched it. And it was the same thing even back then. She came literally just for that.
Yeah.
She had quit acting.
We can just assume she's in college again, whatever.
Right, exactly.
It's funny because I wasn't even thinking about that.
They don't even mention her.
Well, because in the movie, I kind of forget like which ones are like the kids, which ones are the cousins,
the friends,
and, like the neighbor.
But
like,
you think too, you have like, 15 minutes? You don't have time to waste talking about another character. You know? Just move on.
Yeah. And then, of course, playing the role of Dr. Nigel Channing is Eric Idle.
Known from the movie Casper.
Yes.
Wasn't too
also long. A little thing called Monty Python.
Wasn't too long ago we did our episode on Journey into Your Imagination, and this predates that. This is the start of the whole Imagination Institute business, right?
That's right. This was the genesis for all of that.
At that time, it was just like, this is kind of tying it into Journey into Imagination and kind of hangs on there off to the side, not necessarily directly connected. Then. Mm-hmm. Late, like, I guess kudos for trying to make it all connected.
Right, it was a good idea.
Yeah, just a bad execution.
Now, curiously, Eric Idle was not the first choice for this role. There was someone else cast as Nigel Channing. We don't know who. I cannot find this anywhere. But the original actor became unavailable, like, as production was starting. So, as the story goes, Marcia Strassman, again, who played Diane, was leaving her hotel to go to set, ran into Eric Idle, somehow was start talking to him and convinced him just like come visit the set, and they're like, do you want to play this part? And he's like, sure.
Oh, nice.
And that's how he got cast in this part.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Right.
And all the and then that's how you get
the Imagination Institute, and that's how you get Journey into Your Imagination. So it's all her fault.
And it's all her fault.
It all leads up to him as a terrifying man in the moon at the end.
You have to use your imagination better, Mike.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
It works best when it's set free.
We're crazy.
You do that.
About imagination.
That's right. Last two kind of big roles in the film are the reporter in the pre-show, played by Catherine Lanassa, and the kind of assistant, the woman in the blue dress you see in the show. Her name is Meadow Sisto, the actress is Meadow Sisto. She plays a character called Christy Smithers.
I like that name, Meadow.
Meadow.
That's nice.
Like Meadow Soprano.
Yes.
So there were two different pre-shows that were active during the show's run. In the original incarnation, there was a 6-minute presentation by Kodak that touched on themes of imagination using imagery and inspirational quotes set to the song True Colors by Cyndi Lauper. But it was a cover of the song sung by two unknown performers.
I remember the first time we did this attraction. It's funny because I have no memory of ever doing Captain Neo or Magic Journeys or anything. It's the first time I remember going to this theater. I remember watching this pre-show, which really is just a slideshow. It's not much.
Yeah, it's just static images and text.
And, this attraction is still pretty new. And next door in the main theater, you would just hear loud noises and people screaming.
It had to be the mice or the snake.
Was.
One of the two.
So scared.
Like, what's going on there?
And I was like, Truca. And I'm like,
man, I'm trying to calm you and soothe you.
I was terrified.
You know, it's funny too. You mentioned that you can't find the name of the person who sings the songs there, the duet. It must have been the Disney choir, because even things like what Make It Memories and things like that, the stuff that they've done, sure. You cannot find.
Yeah, they just didn't.
And I want to know, because I was so obsessed with that song for so long. I wanted to hear other things she had done. Yeah, I want to know, and I cannot find it.
Tammy Tucky will figure it out.
Yeah, please. If somebody knows, I just want to like look up her other music.
There was a guy listed on Wikipedia, but I could find no source to back it up. Even like the footnote that was like the reference didn't say his name, so I didn't.
Yeah, can't trust it.
And the way this pre-show is designed, like, and the way it was, like, they weren't worried about you catching the beginning of this. Like, this was where you were kind of meandering into the
It's kind
the
of
area.
Like the original pre-show journey, or into Universe of Energy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right, with, like, the kaleidoscope thing going on there. Like, everyone was Ellen. Like, yeah, it's story, but you can come in late. It's fine. Mm-hmm.
So we get to the kind of proper pre-show, which has Dr. Nigel Channing, and he's frantically trying to get things ready for the presentation of the Inventor of the Year Award to the Imagination Institute, and we were watching a broadcast of WNN-TV, World News Network.
Nice and generic.
Yes, and the anchor, Jan, trying to get an interview with Nigel Channing to figure out what's going on. So he explains that they're giving the Inventor of the Year Award to Wayne Szalinski, and she questions his choice and starts holding up newspaper headlines of all the disastrous results of his inventions.
Yeah, she has a good point.
Yes, she's not wrong. He explains that they exercise great safety at the Institute and wear heavy duty protective wear when working with new inventions, and audience members will receive these. And he holds up pair of the kind of standard Disney 3D glasses.
It's pretty good. It's a good gag. And I like how they work into this show. People in the screen audience are wearing
the safety
goggles. Good gag.
So that's how you're going to get your 3D glasses.
Right. And I mean, I like this pre-show a lot. And it's interesting because it is filmed in that hallway where you would be waiting by Disneyland, right?
No. Right? That's where they showed it.
That's where they showed it there. Okay, it almost looked like exterior. It could have been there to me for some reason. No, I misunderstood.
It's just like a generic kind of
stuff. I guess we didn't touch that this is in Disneyland also.
That's
this
coming
show.
Later.
I'm sorry, I'm done.
Yeah.
Skipping ahead.
I'm
ruining like my cardinal flow. Sin.
I'm adding color.
Let's skip ahead to 2003.
You're not.
When the pre-show was changed.
now we're skipping ahead.
Thank you for the transition. Yeah. True Colors was replaced by this weird little short film that was kind of just a long Kodak ad. Yeah. There's like a boy looking for his dog, and then
this
family
is what
reminiscing
I
of their some wedding photos where a frog caused all kind of chaos.
Yeah, the frog is a CG frog later and talks.
Yeah, it's very bizarre.
I wonder if it was by the construction.
And it's like
company.
They keep talking about imagination, and you're like, this is just pictures. You're taking photos.
Yeah, we're not imagining
with Kodak
anything.
Film, Kodak printers. So it has that. And then it goes into the second half where they got rid of the whole thing with Nigel Channing backstage, and it's just like him doing like a slideshow-ish presentation to welcome you to the Institute.
Yeah. It's an odd choice.
It's
to
like
change.
Static images. Yeah. It's new audio recorded by Eric Idle,
which I bet they recorded when got him back to do all the stuff for Journey into Your Imagination.
Right, but it's
the first or second time.
Yes, it's just very odd that like they changed it and made it
right.
worse.
Yeah, because it's just a slideshow. I guess it's more direct and there's more safety information. Maybe that was the problem. You still have some background about who Szalinski is and like the plots of the first two movies.
Right, and the one thing that this does introduce that you don't quite catch in the first pre-show, the helmet camera that he mentions.
Yeah.
You can see in the show people wearing that helmet camera, and that's the perspective of the side camera, like monitors. Yeah. It's from those. Okay. You can see the actors filming with their heads throughout the whole thing.
It's funny, this pavilion had quite the history of taking good things and making them worse.
Just a little worse. We do learn of past winners of the Inventor of the Year Award. It includes Walt Disney himself, as well as George W. Carver, Thomas Edison, and George Eastman, who, of course, is the founder of the Eastman Kodak Company. So,
sponsor.
That's the only way most people would know about him.
He invented film, which is never going away.
All right, let's get into. I'm not going to do like a full plot synopsis necessarily of the show, but I do want to kind of talk about all the technical bits of it, which is practically a synopsis. So buckle up. Here we go.
All right.
The majority of the film is presented as almost like a live stage show, an award show. So it's there, like I said, there's no fourth wall. You're not watching a movie. You're in a theater, and there's a stage. And like I said, they presented it like there was a scrim, there was a stage, there was people behind it, so they had to create this all to scale.
Right, and like I said, you know, Muppet Vision did something almost similar. Like, you're in an actual theater and there are the curtains. But, like, once the curtains are up...
Like, the theater's moving somehow.
Right. Like, you know, Fozzie and Kermit's face still, like, take up most of the screen. You're not, like, really watching a stage.
It's, right.
They admit you're watching a film.
Right. So, there's a tech team headed by a guy named Tom Smith from ILM. And they actually calculated the distance they need to film from and project from to duplicate the actors and set to have that one-to-one life scale.
That looks great. It looks very
and
good.
And that has to be difficult because it can't only be perfect from certain seats, right? Because there's a front row and there's a back row and there's a middle row.
Right.
So I guess they had to calibrate that for sort of the middle and this kind of accept that it'll...
Just where the projector is.
It still works because the 3D glasses kind of fix perspective a little bit and stuff. So, yeah. They had two screens off to the side, like I mentioned. These were showing like what was essentially the broadcast view of the awards show. Now, you guys asked me this, if they were like filming both simultaneously. It looks
I mean, I was trying to see.
Now, take this with a grain of salt, because like you can't see it because we don't have a high enough resolution video of the like main show. But according to what I read, if you look towards the end, Adam is wearing the full safety glasses on the main screen, but on the sub screens, it's just the frames.
Okay.
So little anachronisms like that do pop up, I guess. But boy, like
it's synced.
They're nailing the actors are nailing their movements, they like are. Recreating them because it's if you look back and forth, it's pretty close. So maybe it's just like a couple times there's a different take or something goofy or who knows. But it was a neat effect because it kind of gave like because everything was so far away from you, it was a good way to be able to still see close up detail of the actors and stuff like that if you needed to see it. Now, they filmed on two giant 65-millimeter cameras. One shot straight out. The other was aimed downwards and bounced off a beam splitter mirror, and that's how you get your left and right eye. They used a massive amount of lighting on the set because they didn't want film grain to appear because that would ruin the illusion that this is real. So it's a combination of lots of lighting and high-resolution film, and that kind of gets rid of the film grain. They built the show around the structure of 10 big 3D moments, and they kind of kept them spaced pretty evenly, and that kind of dictates the pace of the show.
Yeah, and there are definitely moments where there's like a longer gap. Like once like they're shrugged, they kind of hit a bit more frequently. So it builds. It's not like perfectly spaced, but it's a great format.
Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of the show, as you're coming in, there's like this projected Imagination Institute logo on kind of like a, like I said, like a dark scrim. That, when you're walking in, is just like a static slide of that image. And then what they do is the show kind of starts after the cast member gives the safety spiel, please remain seated, no flash photography, blah, blah, blah. There's like a flashing kind of explosion behind the scrim, and that masks the transition from this slide to the actual projection start.
That's neat.
And now you can kind of see through the scrim to these people behind it. There's a gag where one of the people behind the scrim kind of pushes their face up against it so they can kind of see who's in the audience. This was inspired by a similar effect from a guy named Doug Trumbull, who created this technology called ShowScan in the 70s. ShowScan was the idea that if we film in higher resolution film at faster frame rates, films will look more realistic. So he developed a process of filming 70-millimeter film at 60 frames per second. He had this demo that he toured around, and it was showed at this convention called ShowEst in 1986. Here's an account of what this looked like, this gag that he's talking about, the script. The presentation began with what looked like a scratchy 16-millimeter image centered on the screen. After a few minutes, the film broke. The lights came up. You saw a door open behind the screen, and the silhouette of a man walk towards the screen and begin apologizing. And asked if there are people out there. He pushed his face into the screen, where you can clearly see the contours of his face distorting the screen. After a second, you realize there was no man behind a screen, there was no screen light shining down on the screen, and this entire sequence is being projected onto a blank screen. The level of the illusion was stunning.
Really?
You know what it reminds me of?
Interesting.
You know in Singing in the Rain, like the audio gag? Yeah. Like, come out from behind the thing?
Yeah, it's just, right.
It's like that, but for video.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that this is something that's really only kind of coming alive in theme parks now. Like, you know, if you listen to our Universal episodes, you heard us just praise and go on and on about that Bourne stunt
show. Well, you got to wonder, what would this have looked like with the Bourne technology now?
Right, yeah, right.
Exactly. But I don't know if you noticed, but now I wonder, was like the film for the 3D thing itself at 60 frames per second?
I believe so.
Okay, so that's how that helps with that illusion. Okay, mm-hmm, cool.
To make it look real. So while he was researching 3D attractions, Kleiser noticed that usually when that first major 3D effect would happen, the audience would all reach out and try to touch it.
Mm-hmm.
We've all done this.
Yeah.
You know, Kermit pushes, or Gonzo pushes that 3D through the door, and we're all reaching up and swatting at it, and there's nothing there. He saw this with the kite and Magic Journey.
Oh, you know what's another, I'm sorry, just like another good one was when Donald kind of like his flute or whatever it does. He throws.
Yeah, he throws the flute.
Boomerangs it.
Everybody goes.
There's the asteroid at the beginning of Captain EO.
Yeah.
So he wanted to take advantage of the audience doing this. And the first 3D moment of the show is when a shrunken Wayne Szalinski flies out on his invention, the Hover Pod, which is a personal hovercraft. And it's got these very noticeable spinning blades on the bottom. And it's kind of timed up where hopefully when the audience is trying to reach out and touch this thing, it kind of angles outwards a bit. And Wayne says, oh, careful, those blades are sharp.
This is
like
good.
A great, like, kind of gotcha.
Like a slight hand.
And there's also like fans blowing the audience. That's the 4D aspect. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also kind of like the first hint you get that it's kind of
so scary.
It's kind of scary and dangerous. You always seem to be in danger.
Yeah. I am on vacation.
Yeah, exactly.
They also do the effect where he like looks at you and it's like, you know, having a good time. Because they could do that with 3D.
All these other people think I'm talking to them, but I'm really just talking to you.
Yeah. The way they filmed this was Rick Moranis was on a crane-like rig that was kind of waving him around, and then they just superimposed a CG hover pod on top. It looks great.
I want to see the footage of him doing that.
Yeah, some behind the scenes would be wild of that. As he flies off, you could kind of see like the pod flips back enough that you don't see him for a second. When it flips back, it's now a digital double as it flies off into the distance. That's our first major 3D effect.
There you go.
We're going to count these. So
that's one.
Yes, thank you. Because this is a live event, that meant there could be no cuts, technically speaking, in the show. But you really couldn't film this all in one take.
Yeah.
So they use a combination of
power. What is this, Goodfellas? Yeah. I mean, come on.
They use a combination of power blackouts and moving mat set pieces to create breaks, cuts, and transitions.
Once you know that, it's fun watching it. Like early on,
you never know.
Early on, it's a lot of those blackouts, and they last for like a second. And later, especially when you're small, it is this like rolling cart kind of.
Yeah, they become obvious.
Someone walks by and takes up the whole frame. Yeah,
it's great.
So the second 3D effect is the Inventor of the Year neon sign comes down as Dr. Nigel Channing is trying to introduce Wayne Szalinski. The sign is CG. They took great care to like line up its position data so it was like hanging in the right spot in 3D space. Wayne comes flying back in out of control and crashes into the sign.
Nerd!
Revealing the letters nerd illuminated before he hits it again. And what I always thought was an oddly violent explosion of this sign.
Again, more violence, more us being in danger.
Yeah, like tons of
glass shards flying at us.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah, they get you. They get you. So like you mentioned, there's neat kind of detail. We see Adam and some of the audience members wearing the same 3D safety glasses that we are wearing. Because
I thought those weren't safe to wear walking around. They got a baby doing it.
No. Those are Muppet Vision's glasses. Oh, right, they're completely different.
Would you stop this foolishness?
What kind of foolishness would you like to see?
Would you get off? Get off.
I got Donald Duck.
You'll notice that he brings up Nick and Adam. Nick has his pet snake Gigabyte. A python, which Eric Idle has a big reaction to.
Oh, a Monty Python. Okay, cute. Look, I know he's a nerd. Would he really name a snake Gigabyte?
Of course.
He's the dog's named Quark.
In the 90s, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Early 90s.
You had to know he was a nerd, Mike.
Gigabyte was a lot back then, man.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's... Yeah.
You probably didn't have a single gigabyte of space on a computer then.
No.
No way.
Not at all. They have the mouse Photon, but it's actually a rat. It's a lie.
No.
Rats are bigger and easier to see. So it's a white rat.
Especially when you have 999 of them.
Yeah. So, yes, they're going to demonstrate the dimensional duplicator because Nick knows how to turn it on.
Also, by the way, I like that he invented a duplicator. Like, world hunger solved, I guess.
Yeah, I guess we're good.
That's fine now.
They have 999 apples.
No, not apples. Big Macs, just something useful. Something with nutrition, AJ.
Yeah, excuse me.
That people actually want to eat.
Now, this is perhaps the most infamous effect of the entire show. As the rats or mice are duplicated, there's a power blackout, and they say, where are the mice going? They're going to the audience. And they do this effect where there is a combination of compressed air and small little rubber hoses that are just flicking on the back of your legs.
And hated this.
It is the most terrifying thing to have ever happened to me.
And they even time it's like as the mice come into the audience, it hits the front row first and then it makes its way toward the back. Two things. One, incredibly realistic effect. Really well done. Just really like feels like the real thing. And number two, how dare they? Like, oh my. And I told you already, I was like scared going into this.
Right.
So already there's like a couple scary things happening. Then this happened. Oh no. I was not happy.
Nothing on Alien Encounter was as bad as this. It had the same effect, and it wasn't this scary.
That's the funny thing, is this really was one of the scariest attractions they ever made at Disney.
Oh, it's incredible.
I'm like, why is this so scary?
I love it's such a cool detail that they didn't just turn them on all at once. That layered.
Yeah. Well, because you hear the people screaming in front of you.
Wonder what's going on.
You're like, what's going on? Oh, my God. So one thing that we learned from the commentary, which is really interesting to me, you normally can't completely black out a theater because you have to have exit signs on in case of an emergency. They got special permission. It's unclear if it's just in this instance of blackout or if he meant the whole show, but they got special permission to turn off the exit signs. So it truly is pitch black as these mice start making their way into the theater. Wild.
Again, that doesn't help with the scariness of it.
No, not at all.
So, and I remember, it is a very special kind of pitch black that it got in there.
It really was. The third big 3D moment is the Holopet. So in an effort to scare off the mice, they're going to turn on Wayne's Holopet, which creates a holographic kitty. They decide to give it more power to scare more mice away. It starts transforming it into a lynx.
I like how giving it more power evolves it.
But now it's too much power and it turns into a lion.
Oh, even this, like the kids screaming, like, it's too much. And it becomes this lion. Everything is terrifying here.
This lion swats at the audience and everyone's screaming. It scares the mice out. So they run back up to the front of the other theater. And this was actually one of the notable CG effects, as mentioned, done by Kleiser Walzak Construction Company.
It's also a scene you probably saw a lot if you were watching like the preview channel in your hotel room.
Yes, they like this one a lot. The fourth big 3D moment is when the shrink ray gets you. So, of course, Wayne tries to shrink a family's luggage. He can't control the shrink ray because he's too short, apparently.
Yeah, it just really bumbled it.
Yeah, he really screwed that one. A step stool would have solved a lot of trouble.
He looks so funny in such good acting, flailing around when he's stuck on
physical
that.
Physical comedy of
yeah,
that.
It's great.
So the beam is about to hit Dr. Nigel Channing. Nick pushes him out of the way, and so the beam hits him and us as we are shrunk.
Let Nigel take the hit.
Yeah, right? I always thought this effect looked great. You can kind of see with the flash of light where it transitions from him on set to like him in like some kind of rig flipping through the air. But boy, did it look cool.
Yeah.
Like him floating in 3D in front of you as you're shrunk down. The shrinking effect looks great.
That was a good effect.
To back up real quick, as Wayne's coming out after he makes himself big again, you hear like the sound of the shrinking machine. This is actually the same sound Captain EO's ship made as it takes off at the end of the film.
Little
throwback.
Reference there.
I meant to say that sooner. But anyway, as you're shrinking, this is where you find out that the entire theater is on a motion base capable of moving 4 inches. So as you're shrinking, the theater shrinks down 4 inches.
That's cool.
So you actually are shorter. Not by much.
Right.
It's not quite as dramatic as, like, say, that little drop at the end of Terminator 2 3D.
No, but throughout the show, they do use it. So, like, if someone, you know, falls in front of the theater,
you get, like, a bunch.
It bumps and shakes.
Terminator 2 3D does predate this a little bit in terms of, like, being a 3D show that is kind of, at least in parts, like, a presence to it, right? Like, there is a stage. There are other times where it is just a movie again.
And then it goes back to being on stage. Right. Yeah.
Kind of a weird format over there.
It works.
Yeah.
All right, now we're little. So now we have to change the way we film this, because if you were to just kind of put the camera in the ground and try to have an actor in front of it, you'd have the problem where you'd have depth of field coming into play, where the background would get really blurry because you have to be close to the camera and get that sharp close focus. So they film it in three layers. Nick, who's been shrunk with us, is a layer by himself in the foreground. He's running around the front of the theater. He's interacting with people. He's kind of now the audience's line of communication with everyone else. There's a middle layer, and this is kind of where the main actors are interacting with us, getting down on their hands and knees, talking to Nick, talking to us. That's just, again, filmed in front of some kind of green screen or matte black screen and comped out. And then there's a background layer that has the sets, the extras, and everything else. And that's how you create a sharp image, even though there's a lot of depth to it. We have our fifth 3D moment. This is when Wayne gets down. He shines a flashlight into the theater. It's just kind of over our heads as he's making sure everyone's okay. Again, as he kind of hits the ground, there's like a thud with that. We have our sixth 3D moment where Diane comes out, says, Wayne, thank God you're all right. What's going on? Honey, I Shrunk the Audience. Roll credits.
Do you think when they filmed the first time he said, Honey, I Shrunk the Theater, you think they already had the name at that point?
Well, I don't know, because he said it's set off screen, so it
could be fixed.
They also made that call, I think, before filming would have been done. So, they probably knew by then.
Diane falls, the hand stretches out. Man,
the way she lands, it's good.
Yeah, man, movies and TV when I was a kid made me think that women would just pass out randomly all
at a moment's notice.
And it wouldn't be a big deal. It's
get her up. Just faint it again.
Yeah, and then Aunt Nanny passed out again.
Annie?
I don't know. I was trying to think of a woman's
name. I think you almost said Nanny.
You were close.
I was close. But yeah, she just passed out. Everyone's like, oh, geez. I'm like, right? That's a problem.
Yeah, that's not good. That's
don't
not
touch
normal.
Her neck. I don't know. Lift her legs up.
Now, you'll notice throughout this whole bit how important the eye lines are between the layers of film. In this moment when kind of Dr. Channing gets down and tells Nick, like, his mom will be okay, like, they're looking at each other. Like, they're really nailing that. What they did is, as they filmed and then moved on to the next shot layer, they had just cassette recordings of it that they could watch for reference, and that's how they just kind of learned their sight lines.
Mm-hmm.
Also, throughout this whole thing, I think Nick is doing, like, such a good job of, like, interacting like with the when the theater moves, right. He's like swaying around.
It's real smart to have him shrink with us, right?
Right. Let's see. We have our 7-3D effect now. This is where Adam kneels down to take a picture of us. His zoom lens of his camera sticks out into the
sticks
theater.
Out real far.
And then
good
he
effect.
Takes that picture with the flash turned on. There's a strobe light that goes off in the theater. He's almost blinded us, you little brat.
Yeah.
So you're not supposed to take flash photos in a theme park attraction. Mike, what are you doing?
I'm sorry.
How dare you?
I almost blinded you. I almost got us kicked out of the park. I really screwed up.
You did. All right. Adam leaves. And this is where you see one of the first kind of mat wipes when a cart passes by. This is the transition to a new shot in the background layer. If you're watching this on YouTube and this cart goes by after Adam leaves, you'll notice they're like on the right side. A bunch of scientists just appear who like weren't there when after this cart goes by. So when you're looking for it, you'll see the transition. I've never noticed this, never would have noticed
no.
it. You don't know. You're just in the experience.
Well, you're still terrified and traumatized, so you're not noticing much.
Right.
Yeah, you don't know what's going to happen next to you. Like acid rain's going to start falling on you or something. I don't know.
So Adam, I guess, is mad that his brother yelled at him, so he decides he's going to pick up the theater of little people to show it to his mom. So he picks up the theater. You can see his hands on the edge
that,
of the screen.
I always love that. You. Yeah.
And he starts walking around with it and was like, Adam, put down the theater. Easy, easy. And he walks by a guy wearing one of the camera helmets, and then there's a monitor there, and you could see a live shot of us. And it's just him holding a model with little
figures. It's always a very good effect. A little bit less so when the theater wouldn't always be filled, but it was a cool
effect. Right. That was like the problem if it was an empty theater.
He would always like look for you.
That's not actually us.
Yeah, right.
But they did a neat thing where he kind of turns away for a second and comes back. You see the screen again. It's zoomed in. And there's a very noticeable guy in a white shirt in the middle of the frame. That is director Randall Kleiser making a cameo in his movie. Look at that. Then a lady in binoculars kind of walks by and gawks at us as her binoculars extended to the frame. That's our A3D effect. And she's also masking another background transition. So again, like another wipe happens behind her. You can kind of see it. So as we're moving around this kind of handheld moment where Adam's holding the theater, they had to be able to make it look like a handheld camera, but it's this massive camera rig that weighs as much as a refrigerator.
Right.
So they actually used a winch and chain system to kind of suspend the whole thing, and the camera operator kind of just kind of guide the chain to move the whole rig around. So that's how they created this handheld effect throughout this whole thing. Now we get our ninth 3D effect. It's the snake. Gigabyte's come back. No.
Great.
He wants us all.
Now they do a clever thing where when he kind of strikes at us, he turns his head sideways, and this allows the snake to take up more of the screen to make it all the bigger and more.
Makes it more scary.
Yes. Quark the dog runs in to save us. Fun fact. So there was a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids TV series that started in 97, I believe.
All I ever knew about that TV series was a poster they had for it outside the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids playset.
That's right.
That's all I ever knew. I never saw,
never saw an episode.
It was not like, you know, the actors from the movie in that or anything.
No, but an actor from that show is in this attraction. It's the dog. It's the same dog playing Quark. Matisse was his name.
Good for Quark finding work.
Yeah. another cart rolls in and kind of stops in frame. That's to reset again. Diane and Adam kneel down and kind of talk to Nick for a second.
Yeah, she's fine as they're passing out, I guess.
Right. We're making jokes now about the whole situation.
Yeah, now it's just funny.
So now Wayne's found the fuse he needs to fix the shrinking machine. The cart moves. They get up. They leave the middle frame and then re-enter in the back frame. So they had to like time that just right. The shrink ray comes in and blows us back up. We get the kind of cool zooming out, we're growing effect, and boom, we're back. Actually, they make a funny joke when Adam's setting the theater down. Like Dr. Chang's like, just put it back exactly where it was. Otherwise, the exits won't line up. Pretty good. All right, so as we're blowing back up again, you can kind of watch. There's like almost like three separate shots involved in the blow up. You can kind of see the transitions happen with like screen flashes.
Yeah.
So again, really cool effect. So everything's back to normal, handshakes and hugs all around. Wayne gets his award. But if you'll notice, as we were getting blown back up for just a second, Quark runs in between us and the shrink ray, and he gets blown up too. So for our 10th and final 3D moment, Quark comes into the stage. He starts kind of barking at everybody. They're all freaking out. Close the curtain, and then Quark pushes his nose through the curtain, takes a few sniffs at us, and sneezes. It's the classic effect where water blows on our faces from little sprayers in the backs of each of the seats.
One last little thing to traumatize us on our way out.
Exactly.
Yeah, you got dog boogers on you.
Yeah. Also, it's funny. At the time, I never noticed, but like looking at the scene now, it's like, oh, it's clearly a puppet.
It is a puppet.
It's a good puppet, though.
It's good.
It is a puppet that is three times larger than the normal dog would have been filmed against a 1/12 scale miniature curtain. That piece of trivia I learned by watching someone play the Honey, I Shrunk the Audience section of the Walt Disney World Explorer. Wow. That was the trivia button on this attraction. Because, you know, Michael, most people think it's water, but it's not.
Oh yes. Very good joke.
Sometimes,
did you get it, Mike?
Sometimes the cast member would say that as you were leaving the theater. So that's the attraction and all of its many incredible effects. I just think, you know, we have It's Tough to Be a Bug. We're going to get the Zootopia one. There's something so much more interesting about these things when it's live action to me. Muppets works to this day, I think, because there is like a sort more of a how did they do that?
Right. And not that, you
just
know,
like, I know how they did a stuff do, but it's a CG film.
Right. Not that CG is easy to do, but like making a CG movie 3D all of a sudden isn't necessarily a more complicated process.
Right. But
there's
still
design that has to go into it and thought that has to go into. But yeah, there's a lot of practical real world problems you have to think about.
Right. Having Sweetums come out with a ping pong battle is more impressive to me than like, anything else that happened in like Shrek 4.
Right. And I mean, even though this is, quite a while ago now, this is the last original film made for that theater to this day.
Yep. Let's talk about how the attraction came to other parks. It first opened on April 15th, 1997 at Tokyo Disneyland. It actually went by the name Micro Adventure! The only major difference aside from dubbing it to Japanese was they reshot the pre-show with Eric Idle still in it, with a Japanese actress playing the WNN anchor, and the whole thing was in Japanese. Eric Idle was dubbed over in Japanese. They had Japanese newspaper headlines. It is so exact. They had to have filmed it at the same time they did the original.
Even though this version opened quite a few years later, I would be shocked if it wasn't the case that they just filmed this
knowing
the same day with just swapping in the news reporter.
It's the same props, the same set, the same background actors. Yeah, I joke, it's like watching the end of Back to the Future and the beginning of Back to the Future 2.
Yeah.
Like, it's like some things off, like the actors.
Yeah, but on the whole, all the beats are exactly the same. So yeah, it's cool they did that. It opened at Disneyland on May 22nd, 1998, in Tomorrowland as part of New Tomorrowland. So this opened with that whole relaunch of the ride.
It opened so much later.
Right, and it still replaced Captain EO.
All four parks had Captain EO. All four of them were replaced by Honey, I Shrunk the Audience.
Well, it seemed like a weird fit there. And we were at Disneyland a few times while this was playing, but we never bothered watching it in Disneyland.
No, we never
I didn't
did.
Even realize the theater was there until Captain EO.
It's kind of hidden,
It was just like literally below Space
Mountain.
It's
like that small path there.
Mm-hmm. Disneyland Paris, it opened March 29th, 1999. Also known as Cherie, je retissais le public.
The public.
The only difference here was they had the True Colors pre-show, but this was the Cyndi Lauper version of the song not the cover.
Cyndi Lauper's lawyers aren't really checking out things in France.
Remember, she was supposed to be in Hunchback and then was really bummed when they didn't use her?
No, really not.
She was going to play Laverne, but then they decided to make the character kind of older. The only other major change was the Epcot attraction getting a Fast Pass entrance in 2000, and then the previously mentioned 2003 pre-show update. Which also came to the other parks.
It's such a it's weird that much later they made the pre-show worse for no reason.
Right?
Can you imagine using a Fast Pass for this?
I remember this would be like I remember getting bonus Fast Pass for this a lot. Oh, yeah. Like you would get a Fast Pass for Test Track, and it was kind of like slip you one of these too. Like literally in the machine, it was programmed to do that. Like, hey, why don't you go do this too?
Old Fast Pass.
Yeah. Any Fast Pass with a theater was never really.
That's why they would
keep it
free.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like you're all gonna get in anyway.
Muppet Vision had Fast Passes for a bit. Certain point they just all did.
Mm-hmm. So this ride came to a close in large part because Michael Jackson died on June 25th, 2009.
It's been that long ago.
All right. This created a sudden huge resurgence of interest in Captain EO online. There's actually petitions and everything to bring back Captain EO. In September of 2009, the Disneyland location was actually temporarily closed to allow Jackson's family to watch a private screening of Captain EO.
Yeah.
So on December 19th of 2009, they announced that Honey, I Shrunk the Audience would temporarily close in Disneyland to present Captain EO Tribute. The Paris show closed on May 3rd, 2010, Epcot May 9th, and Tokyo May 10th. They were all called temporary closures, but as we know, never came back.
Well, again, the timing kind of worked out here. This show had gotten kind of old at this point.
The IP was pretty dormant.
It was pretty dormant, and you know there was that resurgence of interest in Captain EO. So it was time to swap out for something, and at this point it was like, yeah, I may as well run in Captain... Like, Captain EO was aged, sure, but so was Honey, I Shrunk the Audience.
Yeah, and Captain EO had that kind of retro...
There's a retro thing to it. Even though the tribute was never... Like, some of the practical effects were missing, like a lot of the laser effects and whatnot.
Right, but they did use some of the new effects that were installed for Honey, I Shrunk the Audience. The fans were used.
Oh, nice.
The shaking seats, stuff like that.
But, I mean, this never had a chance to come back anyway, because at this point, like mid-2010s, so many movies had 3D in them, just the regular theater.
Yeah, we were well
that,
past...
That fad was like, it was gone.
We were well past the world of Avatar, right? Yeah, and I think a lot of these had that problem where it's just like, seeing a movie in 3D is not inherently special
right.
anymore.
So really, this may have had a chance to come back if that really wasn't the case.
Maybe.
But...
To this day, each theater has met a different fate after the Captain EO tribute was done. At Epcot, it is now the Disney and Pixar Short Film Festival. You'll see things like Get a Horse...
Yeah, it's
not like a collection.
It's
of
just it's kind filler. Of a, yeah. It's a bummer. It's just filler. Like this theater that has these three great 3D film attractions that broke ground.
Yeah,
and it's just
and again especially this you know
what
like,
do you do there though?
Well, I mean, we just saw it Universal. They replaced you know their 3D thing Terminator 2 3D with what I think is a really exciting and interesting and innovative attraction right now. Like you can do interesting new theater shows. They don't even have to be 3D.
Right.
Even in Hollywood, they have a Kung Fu Panda show that isn't 3D, but it's neat. It's interesting. You could do something.
They got it figured out. The Disneyland Magic Eye Theater is now the Tomorrowland Theater. They mostly use that for sneak peeks of upcoming films.
Yeah, they had that Path of the Jedi there for a while.
Yeah, during the Seasons of the Force. I don't know if that still comes back anymore.
I don't think it comes back anymore.
I saw it once. It was really cool.
It was there for a while. For a good long time, that one was there.
In Disneyland Paris, this is where they would put PhilharMagic.
Yeah.
That's still going. Yeah, that's still 3D film in there. In Tokyo Disneyland, this became Stitch Encounter, which is like Turtle Talk, but with Stitch.
I saw this over at Paris, actually.
Yes, they also have it in Hong Kong and I think Shanghai, too.
Yeah, it's cute.
The Imagination Institute and Dr. Nigel Channing, of course, live on as part of Journey into Your Imagination, which they were introduced in that attraction. As again, like we said, it was an attempt to bridge the two together, and the film went away. This still lingers, like that same Imagination Institute logo. That's what you see when you're in line.
Right.
You know, that's where this attraction's legacy still lives on to this day, I guess, whether you like it or not. It's cool that Wayne Szalinski and the Shrinking Machine are still part of the queue. He's one of the inventors featured along with Philip Brainard from Flubber, Dr. Nigel Channing, and...
And the computer wore tennis shoes.
Isn't there another inventor who's, like, on the wall? Am I making that up? Is it Channing? Or is there a third?
It's Flubber,
It's Flubber guy? Yeah.
It's Flubber, it's Wayne. Is it just Channing?
That's it, yeah.
I think there is a third one. I'm going to think on that, AJ, while you go
ahead. Yeah, okay, you do that. As far as the Honey, I Shrunk franchise, there was plans for a new film called Shrunk, which was originally going to be a reboot for Disney Plus until it evolved into a legacy sequel that was going to star Josh Gad as Nick and was going to bring out of retirement Rick Moranis, who's going to be in like the first thing in like 20 years because he... famously retired from acting, his wife passed, and he decided he wanted to be, you know, there for his kids, so he was done acting.
Right.
And
no reason to.
And yeah, that was it. So he hasn't been anything since Brother Bear, I think.
Yeah, you got to think with the two newer Ghostbuster movies, they really tried to get him.
Yeah, he was in a cricket commercial for Ryan Reynolds a few years ago. Like, that was a big deal. Because it's like, oh my God, it's Rick Moranis. This was supposed to film in early 2020, and then COVID shut down everything. It was supposed to then kind of go back into production like late 22, didn't really happen. And last we heard was sometime in 23, Josh Gad said that it is put on a definite hold. He really hopes to make it happen still, but right now it's not being actively worked on, which is a bummer because why not?
Josh Gad is a pretty good cast for that too.
Yeah, I
like think he kind of looks like him, you know. And like
I mean, the plot synopsis I found, it's kind of derivative of the first movie. He shrinks his kids.
Right. And,
you know, following in his dad's footsteps.
Yep.
So I don't know how that would ever shook out, but hey, could have been fun.
Worked for The Force Awakens.
Yep. All right, so that is Honey, I Shrunk
the Chris is right. The third picture is just of Nigel Channing.
Is it? Okay. I wasn't sure.
Well, wait, you didn't bring up Honey, We Shrunk Ourselves, our favorite.
Oh, yes. That was the direct-to-video sequel. The only returning cast member was Rick Moranis.
Yeah.
Even Diane was played by a different actress for that one.
I liked it.
I did, too. I don't know why. I enjoyed that one for some reason.
We learned about bananas containing potassium.
That's true.
Although watching that with our doctor dad, who's like, there's like orange juice in the fridge when they're trying to find something. He's like, orange juice has potassium.
Drink that.
Oh, well. Any other memories of this attraction you want to share?
Just that it terrified me, honestly. I mean, we did it a few times, but honestly, I was pretty scared.
Yeah, we never really went back to it too often.
We did for a while. And I'll tell you what, now that I've done the research on it, I regret not experiencing it more, especially in the later years. Because as I watch it again and it's I start thinking on it, it might be second after Muppets as far as the 3D film. It's really impressive.
We really did scoff at it there for a while.
Yeah, I was definitely probably harsh on it, again, mostly because I was a coward.
Right.
It does a lot of impressive things. And you're right, there is something about the live action aspect of it that is neat, that you don't see a whole lot of anymore with these kind of shows.
Yep.
Yeah, it had a very cool sign in the front.
Yeah, you know, like the scale replica of the shrink ray at night. It was all lit up. Yeah, that was cool.
It was cool. I mean, it definitely... It's very emblematic of that pretty particular era of Epcot, which I think for a lot of people is kind of this weird transition period. But it's the Epcot that I have the most memories of. Like you had hanger-ons like Horizon, World of Motion probably already on the way out. And yeah, they're ruining Journey to Your Imagination. But there was still a lot of cool stuff there. And, you know, you had Millennium Celebration later and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, the bouncing balls in the corridor.
Yeah, exactly.
The ball sacks.
The ball. Yeah, that's
you
know, it. Ball
you have sack. The best illuminations and all that stuff. So it was a part of, you know, it had a pretty good run.
Yes. It's one of those things. I wish Disney just like figure out a way to like release it for VR headsets or something, so we could just watch it. You know?
Yeah, I was actually literally wondering that people have done that, like, because you can watch just the films on YouTube.
Yeah, but no one has like the source.
Yeah, you need like the left and right eye.
Yeah.
And
Someday. I mean, again, there's nothing happening in that theater. It's a shame.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I mean, wasn't there some permits or something filed recently?
Yes, but they don't know if it's just for the pavilion, so they don't know if it's for that or for the ride. It's a 19-month-long construction that they're doing.
Something's got to happen over there eventually.
Right. Also, sure I we'll bet you if they did bring it back, they would not be allowed to turn off the exit signs anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially given the state of everything.
I mean, I don't think they're going to use that theater as a theater again. Maybe they even combine both show buildings into kind of one.
Got the whole thing to make a bigger space.
Who knows?
I mean, that would kind of be worth it, kind of get back to a bigger... ride itself.
Yeah, it is a bummer that, like, I was going to say Epcot doesn't have a 3D show, but they have shows like Visions of Friends.
They have a ton of shows,
right. They have two Circle Visions.
So. Yeah, you're right. So they're still covered with that, I guess.
Yeah.
They're still theaters. All right, let's reach into the mailbag and see what we find. We have a number of emails and messages this month. Thank you all for your support. Our first one comes from Eric Bobo, and he says, "Greetings, Minotti Brothers. No specific questions, just a thank you for all the Disney entertainment you guys bring every month. I have been a Central Florida local since 2002, but only this year became a pass holder. Typically, my daughter who works for the Mouse would take care of admission, but I really like being able to take advantage as a pass holder by hitting the parks a lot. Now that means solo visits, which is a new thing for me. Being able to pop over after work on a weekday is great, and I love the freedom to do what I want without the whole negotiation of what to do next, when to eat, etc. But that means I have to entertain myself in queues, and I'm not one to talk to strangers much. Thankfully, you guys are in my ear, and I've been going through the back catalog of episodes, makes queue times fly by.
Yeah,
thanks again. Keep it coming.
I specifically love the idea of people listening while they are in line.
Yeah, you might learn something.
At Disney World.
Yeah, I think I've said before, like I've had to do solo trips quite a few times just because I'm out in Disneyland or whatever for work trip or whatever. It's kind of fun to be there.
Right. No, I agree.
Sounds peaceful.
You know, I love going with my family. I love going with you guys. But yeah, I've been like by myself a couple of times. It's nice.
Hey, you got a lot done.
Just do what you want.
I've never been by myself.
Yeah, like when I lived in LA that little bit, I got to the park by myself in Disneyland. And I just had a ball.
Like, I can't imagine just kind of showing up like, what am I going to do now, self?
It's very freeing. It is pretty nice. Not going to lie. All right, our next email comes from Lindsay from Iowa. And she says, "Hello, thanks for your podcast. I listen to it while at work. It sounds like I'm at a similar speed of thrill-seeking as Mike is for
you." I'm sorry for you.
One of me.
"Appreciate the perspective of someone else who enjoys theme parks without necessarily embracing all of the thrill components. I haven't worked through all of your episodes yet, so don't know how much this has been covered already. would be interesting to hear a what rides will Mike go on sort of angle, possibly in an episode. Wondering if there are rides I won't try that I'd be surprised to find out I could actually handle. Glad to find your podcast. Thanks again, Lindsay.
Yeah.
We kind of touched on this. Like, we've talked about, we've had episodes on roller coasters and bonus episodes and things like that. So it's been peppered around, but maybe that we could, like, focus on the bikeability of rides.
And it changes, right? Like, I used to do Expedition Everest, and now I'm just like, eh, not really. There's even, like, I could almost always do Space Mountain. If it's a bad day, though, not feeling it on Space Mountain.
But Disney has a bunch of awesomely themed, like, not too crazy roller coasters. Like, Big Thunder is one you would always do.
Big Thunder I could do
That's
whenever.
Probably, like, the one to, like, kind of start with, see if you can handle it, and kind of really go from there.
Seven Dwarfs is fine. The problem is when it's something, like, kind of new and unknown, because then it's just kind of scary anyway. So, like,
like
Guardians and Tron, I don't know. But I hate that, but, like, sometimes it is like,
And he can't trust us because we've lied to him too much in the past.
You've lied to me before.
Not lies, stretch the truth a tiny bit to force you to do it.
But like I said, you shocked me when you went on Gringotts with us. I didn't realize you didn't know I did that one.
So there's a good one. If you're afraid of Gringotts, I can tell you, don't be. It has like one drop in the beginning, basically, that's not that bad, except that it kind of like, it makes you think about it for a second, and then the drop itself is nothing. It's fun.
More like a fun dark ride than anything.
It really is. And like, even the only other roller coaster section doesn't even really have a drop. It's more of just I wouldn't even call it like a launch. A burst is a good way of putting it. At this point, rides in Disney World I just straight up don't do. I mean, it was Splash Mountain. That'll extend to Tiana. I just don't like very big drops. I will not do
Rock and Roller Coaster.
Tower of Terror.
What about Slinky Dog? Could you do that?
I will probably do Slinky Dog at some point.
Okay.
Guardians of the Galaxy, maybe someday I'll be a brave big boy.
That's like your upper, like,
that and Hagrid's are like, I think you could do it, but it'd have to be a brave day.
Yeah, it'd have to be a brave day. That's about it for like the ones that are just like absolute no-goes. Not going to happen, I think, unless I'm forgetting something. Like
the Incredicoaster.
Right, it's weird. Like, it's like Test Track, like, you know, gets advertised as this big fast thing, but that doesn't bother me like at all. That's just fun. Yeah.
Well, it's like at the point where I was worried for you if you would have found out, I don't know if that's spoilers, in Rise of the Resistance anymore or not. Should we say that?
There's a twist in Rise of the Resistance that we thought Mikey wouldn't like, but he actually enjoyed it.
I remember hearing about it once, and I asked like somebody if it was there, and they rightfully lied to me about it because it's not that big. It's actually pretty fun.
Right.
Don't
stop yourself from doing things like that if you think
it is convenient,
because
Mikey's a good metric for my kids. Like, guys, Uncle Mikey rides this. It's
fine. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, we're good.
Usually works. Yeah. All right, our next email comes from Nicholas McDaniel, and he says, hey, guys, was wondering if we'll ever get any 90s Disney merch. I can see myself in a 90s Disney hat now.
We tried once.
We've toyed with it.
The problem is that our logo has the Mickey Mouse in it.
And the word Disney.
Yeah,
jinx.
Yeah,
they might have CDMA'd us the first time we tried to launch something. We had some stuff we worked on. We just can't find quite the time to fully launch as we want. It's something we want to do. So if you guys are interested in that, let us know. That might motivate us to fast track.
I'm sure we can modify the logo to at least remove Disney.
Even if it's not necessarily the logo. Like I've worked on some designs that are just kind of like references to episodes that we've done in the past.
I'm proud of that logo.
It's a good logo. I think we just took Disney out of it, and it was just the logo itself in the 90s. I think we'd be fine.
We had something else real big, and that got put on hold, and I really want to get that out, Mike.
Yeah, okay, I know. You know I've been busy. Yeah.
No excuses.
Yeah.
I did, well, when you tried to launch the first Tees for your store, whichever one it was, before it shut down, I was able to order a shirt.
Yeah,
Jessica
you got
had
one.
A hoodie. So I do have the one of one 90s Disney shirt. Jessica has the one of one 90s Disney sweatshirt.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can figure something. I'll ask Giant Bomb who does it there these days. Although that might be a bit high for us. Who knows?
All right. This email just came tonight, so I haven't even read it yet. This comes from Tom from Indianapolis. And he writes.
He just curses at us.
You didn't get to parse through it.
Hey, Minotti brothers. I went to Disney World for the first time in 15 years with my family back in February. It was a blast. It was my niece and nephew's first visit, and I think they are hooked. One of my highlights was spending about 90 minutes to myself at the Nomad Lounge while everyone else went back to the hotel to rest.
Yes.
Welcome.
The tempting tigers and churros were as incredible as you all described. Attaboy.
That is the greatest possible spread. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. My sister and I are using your advice to plan our next Disney trip to get over the post-Disney trip blues. We have decided on staying at Polynesian in October of 2025.
Ah, dang.
We are hoping Epic Universe will be open by then and will draw some of the crowd away from Disney World, although we're still expecting it to be busy. Some additional promotions or special offers would be nice, too. What effect do you think the opening of the Epic Universe will have on Disney? Thanks for such a fun podcast.
It's always kind of rough because you like think, like, oh, maybe it's going to draw crowds away, but it also means more people going to Florida.
Right, and it's almost like, well, we're here to see Epic Universe, but that's one park. Let's go to Disney, too.
Honestly, at that point, you kind of hope it's not open yet because a lot of people would just not go to Florida.
Yeah, they'd be open. Waiting for their trip. But that's a good point.
When did he say he was?
October. I think it'll be open by then.
Originally, it was summer 2025. Now they just say 2025.
I think it'll probably still
like end of summer.
But that's a good point. Maybe you could get like weirdly lucky if you're not planning on going to Epic Universe and it's like November or December 25. Yeah. That might work in your favor.
Speaking of Mikey being brave in October in Universal, you know what I really want to do now?
What?
It's Halloween Horror Nights.
That's what you've been saying.
I think that'd be a ton of fun now. Because that's stuff like stuff that is scary.
Don't they grade the haunted houses almost like ski hills? Like by how scary they are? Because there's like a Ghostbusters one that's not like anything crazy.
But think of the cool theme stuff that we've missed out. Like they had a Bill and Ted one at one point.
Yeah, there's a Beetlejuice one that looked awesome.
Yeah, I just think it'd be fun.
Mm-hmm. I was also gonna say when you're talking about promotions and special offers for your trip, use a vacation planner. I am such a convert to this idea. Again, I work with a girl named Heather from Mouse Fan Travel. I'm happy to refer you to her if you'd like. But when you use a vacation planner like that, anytime like a promotion, like a meal plan thing or like a multi-room discount gets announced, even after you've booked, they find that and retroactively apply it to your trip and you don't have to do anything. I remember when we were...
They don't cost anything, right?
No, you don't pay for them at all. Disney pays them basically. When we booked our honeymoon through Heather, I remember waking up one morning before I left for work and I saw on Twitter that they were doing like the free dining plan thing and we were doing the dining plan. So I was like, oh, I'll have to email Heather and ask her about that. And by the time I got to work that morning, I already had an email from her saying, hey, I applied this to your account and it saved like $1,000.
She knew.
Like it was just done. I was like, oh, that's incredible.
I mean, it's their job to constantly scour those things. So yeah, they're going to apply it.
Very handy.
Pretty good.
And Polynesian is just such a nice resort. That's just absolutely
beautiful. Yeah, you're going to have a good time
there. You think the construction on the DVC will be done by October?
I think so.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah,
I think so. Be. Yeah, the building itself is pretty close.
I think they even said end of this year.
Really?
Not that it would be some big detriment to you if that's still happening. It's kind of off to the side. It wouldn't really impact you.
Yeah, while we were visiting there, I didn't notice it.
Honestly, you just have another place to visit. I'm sure there'll be a nice lounge.
One thing I'll tell you is if you want to go inside Trader Sam's,
good luck.
It's been difficult. Like, really get there early and get ready to put your name in and, do something else.
For, an hour.
Because we're even at a loss. Look up some tips of how to
Yeah, I haven't been able to get in there
Unfortunately, I like the outdoor lanai, so that's fine.
It's fine, yeah. But sometimes it's raining,
Yeah. All right, then we have a couple responses on the Spotify Q&A response app, so thank you for listening there. Our first one comes from Christopher, and he says, really have enjoyed the Universal content. Me and my wife surely miss it. We are headed to Walt Disney World in May. What are y'all's opinions on Beer Garden at Epcot and Tusker House? Decisions.
I think that they are both fun. AJ knows more about Tusker House. I'll let you go first.
Yeah, we did Tusker House on our trip a year and a half ago. We took the kids and my mom for a character lunch, and it was Christmas at the time, so they were all in their Christmas safari attire. The safari outfits on the characters are super cool, so that's a nice draw. This is a buffet, and it's a good buffet because this is a lot of more exotic food, I guess, kind of like a lot of Middle Eastern cuisine, a lot of African cuisine. They also have some safe choices there
for the
but
kids.
You know, if you're like, I don't know if I like za'atar rubbed chicken, well, here's your chance to try a piece, and no harm, no foul. If you don't like it, just
did you like it?
Oh, I loved everything.
I did at least run inside there to say hi to you guys and peek around. It's very cool.
Yeah, it's cool inside, and the food was excellent. That meal was so good. The desserts were incredible. So I'm a big fan of that. We've all done Beer Garden.
Yeah, and I did it one more time afterwards with a group of adults, and that was really fun.
Yeah, I guess, are you going, do you want characters, or do you want to drink and sing songs?
I think Beer Garden is really neat. I like the way it looks. The food is very good in that buffet. Is it a buffet again there? You would hope so. It has to be.
Was it, or was it? I thought it was just the table, the big plate.
It was a buffet
back in the day.
That's right. Yeah,
I bet it's buffet again. They do the cool show.
If you ever been to a Hopper House, not sure if you have, you get some comparisons.
But it's way cooler than that.
Way cooler, for sure.
It is definitely high on my list in terms of restaurants I want to go back to, actually.
Yeah, but we just never end up doing it, though. I mean, we just have so many other options.
Yeah, Epcot's a tough sell. There's so much.
I will say, as much as I love Via Napoli, I've done that so much at this point, I'm ready
to
agree.
Yeah, I'm ready to branch
some other
out a little bit.
Again.
Yeah. Like I said, if it comes down to those two, I think that's what you ask yourself. Do you want a character meal with adventurous food, or do you want to drink and sing?
I say do both.
Yeah, just do it. Yeah. Just do it. That's a big
deal. I say do Tusker House.
Let us know what you decide.
If you don't want to do Tusker House and you're looking for like another fun buffet option that may not be quite as expensive, it doesn't have characters, Boma at the Animal Kingdom Lodge Resort right by there is a very nice buffet. Mm-hmm. Similar kind of food, very pretty, but just, not characters.
Or 1900 Park Fair just reopened.
Yeah, a little bit different cuisine you'll probably
different
get there.
Different vibe there for sure.
Yeah.
All right, our last message comes from Perfect Pixie 98, who says, not so fun fact. On January 1st of 2011, Dudley Do-Right caught on fire. Something I will never forget. That being said, I do love that ride so much and glad it survived.
Wow, it's a water ride.
I do remember reading about that.
Was this person there? Like the way it says, never forget.
Perfect Pixie, what were you doing on the day of January 1st, 2011?
Who started this fire?
Look, we figured out who started the fire at Enchanted Tiki Room under new management. Yeah. Have we found the second culprit of theme park arson?
We're on it. We are on it.
Again, I like that ride, but I wouldn't be sad if they announced
it. It was one of the few that you did not do on our last trip. You did almost everything.
Straight up skipped it. Yeah. It wasn't even getting wet was not my objection.
It's still fun, but it seems a bit more cheaply made than the other ones, especially the queue.
We brought this up the other day because we were talking about the Grinch holiday show we saw when we were on our trip, and as I mentioned, it was like the theater where the Blue Man Group used to perform. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you were in Seuss Landing and you had to go like backstage, past the dumpster, into like some like employee only areas, like to this theater. And Jessica's like, Disney would never.
No.
Universal's like, whatever, walk past that dumpster, hang a right, you'll get there.
Yeah. I mean, like Dudley Do-Right, even like the roof was like leaking and stuff. Remember, there are puddles everywhere in the queue.
Yeah, it's
kind of falling apart.
Was that on purpose?
Unfortunately, the ride's maintenance is funded by income that comes in from Dudley Do-Right Media.
Yes.
It's been pretty rough.
And the Royal Canadian Mounties, I believe.
Yeah.
All right, if you want to get your message on the show, you can email us at 90sDisneyPodcast@gmail.com or use the Q&A feature in the Spotify app. You can also follow us on all the social medias. We're pretty much on all of them. And drop us a line. Let us know what you want to hear about, what you want to ask us about, or just what you want to tell us. Thank you for your support as we approach the sixth year of 90s Disney next month.
Really?
Is that right?
Oh. Can you believe it?
Wow, been popular for two.
It's crazy. That's what happens, right? You just gotta stick with it.
Apparently,
everything except Exploding Barrel.
Sorry, guys.
We were too early. We were ahead of our time with that one.
They got the right equipment on that one.
Mike, what are we doing next?
It's summer. Getting close to it, and I always kind of associate summer with miniature golf.
I associate summer with Santa Claus and Christmas.
Yeah. I think of alcoholic beverages.
Well, there's a Winterland, but there's a Summerland. We used to be big fans of both Fantasia Gardens and Winter Summerland, the two mini golf courses that they have at Disney World to this day. I think it'd be fun to see what I can find out about those.
I bet you could dig some cool stuff.
It may be just the whole miniature golf fad that I think was a big part of the 90s in general.
We all called it putt-putt.
We called it putt-putt. We sure did. AJ found a way to cheap out SpaghettiOs. Well, I'll tell that story next time.
Yeah, that's
what I do.
The Sonic thing with our local putt-putt place.
Don't worry,
SpaghettiOs.
Oh, God.
You're giving away.
Yeah, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Core memory unlocked. Wow. Yeah,
we're going to talk about Sonic next month. There you go.
It's going to be great. We'll hopefully have a bonus episode for you in the middle of the month. I don't know what it'll be yet. I'm trying to work on something, but if that falls through, we'll have other things.
We still need to do our potluck and maybe another beverage.
That's going to happen this summer for sure.
Yeah, that cocktail episode we did was a fun
one. That was way too fun.
Look up that one if you haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah, that's a good time.
Yeah, potluck, though. That'd be...
Potluck's a good idea, too.
We'll need something to make some Captain Crunch.
That was on my list.
Chicken Crunch? Uh-huh. Yeah.
I just watched Sam the Cooking Guy. Just today, I watched a video he did. It was seared tuna with a Captain Crunch coating.
Nice.
Maybe think of that.
There you go.
Very inspired.
And I've accidentally made the longest episode of this show we've ever done.
Yeah, how about that? They usually always end up around an hour. Look at that. Of all the ones.
Who knew? Thanks for sticking with us, everybody. We appreciate you listening. We'll see you next time for the sixth year of 90s Disney. Take care.
Good night. Maybe. Depending when you're listening to this.
Oh,
good night to you too.
He's not saying he's wishing them a bad night. He's just saying depending on what time it is.
I didn't know.
Good morning. Good night. How do you do?
He said, "I'll see you."
Take a night like you're underwater.
Wait, now my mouth is dry.
No, you got this. I believe in you.
Wait, talk for a second. I need to lube it up.
Oh, he's going to lube it on up. He's going to stop.
Get it.
The G sounds pretty rough, actually, isn't it? Good luck, everybody.
Good night.